You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Hello, comrades. This is Back in the USSR. I am Siegfried. And in contrast to last week's episode of the show, I don't intend to do a lot of talking tonight. Because frankly, I've barely gotten any sleep. And frankly, there are other people who you'll soon be hearing from who can speak about this matter a lot better than I can. I've talked about Venezuela on this show before. I've done whole episodes about the Bolivarian Revolution, Hugo Chavez, the amazing progressive gains that have been won in that country since neoliberalism was overthrown there in the late 1990s, and I've also spoken about the American Empire's attempts to undermine those gains through violent coups, bloody campaigns of street violence, sabotage, and now with sanctions, blockades, and outright threats of military invasion. In 2015, the Obama administration declared the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela to be a national security threat and instituted sanctions. Since then, the Trump administration has taken things a lot further, refusing to recognize the legitimate elected government of Venezuela under President Nicolas Maduro, imposing an outright economic embargo on the country with devastating implications for ordinary Venezuelans, and threatening direct military intervention. You know, using that infamous phrase so beloved of American war hawks in the Pentagon and State Department, all options are on the table. And even more troubling for me as a Canadian citizen is that Justin Trudeau and the Canadian government have been in absolute lockstep with Trump and his people in pushing for regime change in Venezuela, to the point of inflicting real atrocities on the people there. You know, through the sanctions, embargo, diplomatic isolation, and the like. So to get into this further, I want to play a clip from independent journalist Max Blumenthal of the Gray Zone Project, who's done some of the best reporting I've seen on the current situation regarding Venezuela. Certainly, we get a lot of propaganda, you know, in the mainstream media about this. I mean, we get a lot of propagandists, you know, essentially trying to justify, you know, starving the people of Venezuela in the name of human rights and democracy, and saying that what the U.S. and Canada are doing to that country somehow amounts to defending democracy and defending freedom and all that sort of thing. Meanwhile, of course, people in Venezuela can't get the medicine they need. They can't get enough food. They can't get all the kinds of things they need in life because the U.S. effectively has imposed this blockade on their country. You know, when the U.S. does that, it's never about democracy. It's about control. And that's very important to understand. So Max Blumenthal, I'm going to play this clip from Max Blumenthal of the Gray Zone Project. Like I say, he's done some of the best reporting that I've seen on the current situation in Venezuela. And this is the interview that he did with the Gray Zone's Aaron Mate earlier this week on their show Pushback. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Pushback. I'm Aaron Mate. We're here today with Max Blumenthal. He is the senior editor of The Gray Zone, author of many books, including his latest, The Management of Savagery. Welcome, Max. We're talking today about many topics. Let's start with Venezuela. You just had an exchange on a program called The Heat, which airs on CGTN, which to me really captured the mentality at the heart of the U.S. war right now on Venezuela, because you spoke to, in this exchange, spoke to both a former Obama official and then also a member of the right-wing Venezuelan opposition. Before we go to the clip, why don't you set it up for us?
Well, it was a remarkable opportunity and one that I wouldn't have had in, you know, U.S. corporate media, where no critics of the U.S. regime change policy towards Venezuela are allowed on air. So, you know, you have to go to state TV to actually have a real debate. And I got to be in the room with one top level former NSC official who was involved in crafting Obama's policy towards Venezuela, and the former mayor of the Chacao district of Caracas, Ramon Muchacho, who was mayor basically during the most violent guarimbas, the most violent riots against the government, and presided over some of the most horrific crimes against Chavistas, against supporters of the government in that district. He basically whipped up the guarimbas that saw the burning to death of Orlando Figuera, a black man who was identified as a Chavista and then had gasoline spilled on him and was burned to death. And so, you know, I wasn't going to waste the opportunity, although I had very little time, to not question the people I was in the room with about how they could justify a policy towards Venezuela that was quite clearly harming average civilians, masses of civilians. We're now 2 weeks out from the Trump administration announcing a total embargo on Venezuela, but this wouldn't have been possible without the 2015 decision by the Obama administration to label Venezuela a national security threat. And I think it's patently ridiculous to any sentient being that Venezuela posed no threat to U.S. national security. So it was my intention coming in to just politely ask Paula Garcia Tufro, who is cooling her heels at the Atlantic Council, which is NATO's unofficial think tank in Washington, funded by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Bahrain, and the arms industry, as well as many oil companies seeking to get back into Venezuela, to ask her how she could justify labeling Venezuela as a national security threat. And I think the response, which was a total lack of response, just no substance, was really telling.
So let's go to that. And so we'll see Max ask Paula Garcia Tufro of the Atlantic Council, formerly of the Obama administration. And then we see a member of the Venezuelan opposition, Ramon Muchacho, he weighs in as well. This is from CGTN America's The Heat.
There's so many things that happen below the radar that we don't notice. 300,000 doses of insulin were not able to get into Venezuela in 2017, the year of the violent guarimbas, which were setting the streets on fire because Citibank refused to, they boycotted its purchase. This is the result of the Obama administration's designation of Venezuela as a national security threat in 2015. I want to ask Paula, because you were in the Obama administration, in what way was Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security? How does Venezuela threaten my security or the security of American citizens? Or was this not a tool to bring us to the crisis that we're in, to ratchet up Venezuela's economic crisis and harm ordinary civilians?
So just if I may, go ahead and directly respond to that. So again, I would say from the Obama administration standpoint, the policy was very much one of support for the democratic movement in Venezuela.
Which one would that be?
It was never intended to be.
The one that staged a military coup?
The Venezuelan
movement. The movement that staged a military coup.
Please let her finish first, Leah. Okay. You asked her a specific question. She's trying to answer.
So I would just say, again, the policy was very much of support for democracy, support for democratic movement in Venezuela. It is never one to go after the Venezuelan people. I don't believe, certainly I know to be the case under the Obama administration, and I don't believe it to be the case today.
How was Venezuela a national security threat to the United States? That was the specific language of this designation. Yeah. In what way?
I think there are many reasons to consider Venezuela and Maduro a threat to the U.S. population right here, right now, including drugs, including terrorism, support to terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. Well, Colombian guerrilla being in Venezuela, the mass migrations of Venezuelans destabilizing the economy and the governments of Colombia, Brazil, Peru, Bolivia, and other countries.
How are they connected to Al-Qaeda? Sorry, how are they connected to Al-Qaeda? You've connected them to Al-Qaeda. It was the Obama administration that provided weapons to Al-Qaeda in Syria. We know that. But how is Maduro connected to Al-Qaeda? This is ridiculous.
All right, so that was a clip from CGTN America. Max, let's take that piece by piece. Start with this non-response you got from Paula Garcia Tufro from the Obama administration, asking her what national security threat Venezuela posed to the U.S. She didn't answer your question.
Yeah, because there's no answer to it. There's simply no way of justifying it except that this was a John Bolton-like, George W. Bush-like justification for regime change that wasn't questioned by Congress or anyone of any significance in the U.S. press that I remember at the time. And what it did was it set the stage for an economic boycott of Venezuela by international financial institutions. I mentioned in the lead up to my question that Citigroup had boycotted the purchase of 300,000 doses of insulin by the Venezuelan government. You saw, as a result of this designation, bank or any international financial ratings group like Standard & Poor's declaring, or JP Morgan declaring, that Venezuela was high risk. And so this exacerbated the inflationary crisis and made it very difficult for Venezuela to obtain the credit to refinance its assets. It made it very difficult for it to obtain assets. And 70% of Venezuela's food still comes from imports. And so if you don't have assets, you're unable to, you're unable to export your oil, which is the main source of your assets, then you basically can't buy food. And so it exacerbated the migration crisis as well. So you have someone sitting right next to me who is essentially involved in a titanic administrative crime where, she and her colleagues in the Obama White House were signing away lives with the stroke of a pen. And you've mentioned before, Aaron, that this report by Mark Weisbrot, who's one of the premier experts in this country on Venezuela, and Jeffrey Sachs, one of the world's leading economists, for the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which found that between the between 2017 and 2018, there were 40,000 excess deaths as a result of U.S. sanctions in Venezuela. So, you know, the Trump administration's obviously ramped it up, but this all really began, the economic attack really began with that designation, which she can't explain. She just has no way of doing it. So she kind of hands off the ball to Ramon Muchacho, who is just an absolute fanatic living in Miami right now. And he says, well, the real threat was that Nicolas Maduro is working with Al-Qaeda. And so I said, you know, actually, we were the ones working with Al-Qaeda. You have members of Al-Qaeda's local affiliate in Idlib in Syria right now showing up in the field with BGM TOW missiles produced down the street from me by Raytheon, which the U.S. supplied to the so-called moderate rebels. But I don't know about Nicolas Maduro working with Al-Qaeda. We also hear about him working with Hezbollah. We hear about, you know, him working with drug lords, and they pretty much pile on every accusation, but this was the most ridiculous one. And it's significant. I mean, you could dismiss it as just, you know, a right-wing fanatic in Miami just popping off with, you know, random allegations. But it's significant because Muchacho is really emblematic of the right-wing opposition that the U.S. has attempted to install behind Juan Guaido. And these are the people that Michelle Bachelet, who is the UN Human Rights Commission, depended on substantially for her report, which helped lay the groundwork for Trump's embargo, basically by accusing Maduro of running extermination squads, of using a food distribution program as a spying program, and completely ignoring the testimony of all of the victims of right-wing terror in Venezuela, who actually met with Bachelet when she was there. An investigation by the Venezuelan government's own Human Rights Commission found that 82% of the testimony supplied to Bachelet came from outside Venezuela, from people like Ramon Muchacho, who are exiled members of the right-wing opposition. So, you know, you hear these wild allegations and they sound ridiculous to us, but they're taken seriously by the team that was working behind the scenes on Bachelet's report, who were largely American bureaucrats who'd kind of burrowed from within the UN. So I think it's a really significant exchange. And it's also significant about our media environment that exchanges like this never take place. You know, if you were allowed on, for example, Chris Hayes to interrogate the lies, deceptions, and distortions of half-truths of the Russia Gators, catastrophe would ensue. And, you know, it's the same thing, I think, with Venezuela. There is a certain fear about allowing us to challenge the people who make the sausage in Washington. In this case, you know, I'm sitting next to someone who I think is involved in a vast crime, an administrative crime, but a crime nonetheless that has cost lives. And after the broadcast, Tufro was really upset. And she started wagging her finger at me and telling me that I lied. Sanctions don't affect ordinary people. And I said, really, well, where's the lie? And she said, well, they only target the oil and gold of Venezuela. And I said, yeah, they've stolen $1.3 billion in gold assets through the Bank of England. Citgo, the state oil company's U.S. wing, has been basically put in, entrusted to Juan Guaido's fake government in the U.S. And we don't know where that money's going. That's something like $7 billion in assets. When you deny the government these assets, as I said before, it cannot buy food or medicine, and it exacerbates an economic crisis and, you know, deliberately is attempting to turn that economic crisis into a humanitarian crisis. I tried to point this out to her as we were walking down the hall. She was ignoring me. And then I attempted to share an anecdote from my recent trip to Venezuela that, you know, resulted in her walking towards the elevator and not, you know, really shutting me down. And it took place during a visit to the women's run cooperative of San Agustin, which is a neighborhood high in the hills above Caracas. You know, if you go to Caracas and you look at the hillsides, these are the areas that were completely ignored before the Bolivarian Revolution, when Chavez came to power, when he was elected in 1998. In fact, maps of Caracas didn't even show these areas. San Agustin was one of them, and it was a very hard area to reach because it's just such on such a sharp sloping hillside that people who lived there often wouldn't come down to the downtown commercial areas because it was so difficult to get home. They'd have to walk an hour or two up a hillside, especially people who have disabilities or who are older. They got stuck in their homes. And what Chavez did was he built a cable car through the Caracas metro system with five stops going up that hillside. So I and other visitors I was with, we went up with this women's run collective. It's a food collective to provide food to people in that area who are hard hit by sanctions and by the economic crisis. And we took those cable cars and we reached our destination in 10 minutes. We reached a community center where when we arrived, 40 youth from San Agustin were practicing classical music and they performed classical music for us. But what was really remarkable was that there were two stops that we couldn't reach on that cable car because the cable itself comes from Germany. It was built by a German company. And, you know, Germany is participating in the sanctions regime against Venezuela. And so the cable cannot be replaced. So people have to walk those extra two stops. And this is, you know, just one small snapshot of how the economic attack is affecting the most vulnerable people in Venezuela. And, you know, again, I tried to tell the Atlantic Council fellow and former top-level Obama NSC official about this experience, and she was not interested in hearing it.
And it's interesting to hear them try to rationalize these sanctions. Again, we're not talking about the Trump administration here. We're talking about the Obama circle. They'll claim that these are targeted sanctions, only impacting a few top officials. We heard the same kind of talk in the 1990s when the Clinton administration was suffocating Iraq and killing, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people because of their sanctions, that this is only meant for people at the top. But of course, in real life, the impact of these sanctions is always to hurt the people. And it's striking to hear her inability to respond to you when you ask her to justify the premise for those sanctions, this idea that Venezuela was a national security threat. And it's interesting to hear even today people like Ben Rhodes openly saying that they still support sanctions on Venezuela. Let's go to a clip of him speaking on Pod Save America, the podcast, earlier this year.
Again, I want him gone. Like, we should all be very clear. Like, this would be good. I do think there's a different way to go about this, which is to be tightening the noose, to be tightening sanctions, but to be very intensively trying to negotiate with the different factions inside of Venezuela, frankly, talking to the Chinese and other countries about how to create some soft landing to a transitional government that can then hold an election.
Yeah, I would love for Ben Rhodes to explain how Venezuela was a national security threat and how they justified this. But he's also come out and criticized the Trump administration reimposing sanctions on Cuba. So there is a cognitive dissonance there. Why is it okay to normalize with Cuba as the Obama administration did while ramping up the economic attack on Venezuela? It's obvious that there's a geopolitical agenda behind this and a deep cynicism, the same cynicism embodied by Madeleine Albright when she declared that the deaths of 500,000 children in Iraq due to U.S. sanctions was worth it.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
You know, I've seen, you know, pretty fair criticism of the Lancet study that alleged that 500,000 children died. It doesn't matter because she said that even if 500,000 children died, that would still be worth it. And for these sociopaths, whether they're, you know, former create, you know, young, you know, Twitter-centric former creative writing majors like Ben Rhodes, or they're, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski disciples like Madeleine Albright, there's just a sociopathic mentality that the cost is always worth it to achieve a geopolitical goal, which is to break down independent countries. And Venezuela is the key target in the Western Hemisphere, not only because it has the world's largest oil reserves, it has vast gold reserves, aluminum, rare earth minerals, but because it was able to project influence throughout the region and to begin to gradually decolonize the continent. What we're looking at right now, and actually at the Sao Paulo Forum, where Nicolas Maduro spoke beside the Cuban president, Miguel Diaz-Canel, is the fourth stage, or is sort of the third stage of the of modern Latin American history. The first stage was the beginning, the beginning of the armed struggle through the Cuban Revolution, leading all the way through the Sandinista Revolution in the 1980s, and culminating with the 1998 electoral victory of Hugo Chavez. The second stage, according to Maduro, and pretty much everyone I talked to who is part of this progressive wave, was what's known as the pink tide through Latin America, the integration of the hemisphere from Honduras through Nicaragua down to Ecuador through Rafael Correa, through Lula da Silva in Brazil, all the way down to Paraguay, Chile, although it was the most centrist member, Argentina, and Venezuela was really at the center of it through the ALBA program. It was the economic engine, and it expanded into the Caribbean. So all of these small Caribbean countries, which are still defending Venezuela at the Organization for American States, were participating in ALBA. And if you talk to anyone, whether they're from St. Kitts and Nevis or Honduras, at that time, 2006 through 2008 was a golden age economically, and people were doing better than they ever have before. We got to travel to Honduras. Our colleague Anya Parampil interviewed Manuel Zelaya, the ousted president who was removed in a coup under the watch and under orders from the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton's State Department. And this was the beginning of the third phase, which was the imperial counterattack against the progressive tide. And now we're kind of witnessing the sort of final battle, the ultimate battle. And I think this puts Venezuela on the front lines of the battle against empire, and so many forces, as in Syria, are converging there. China and Russia, even Turkey, countries that are committed to building a multipolar world, are converging there and trying to prevent this country from falling. It really is a war for national survival. And another way of looking at it is to look at the fake government of Juan Guaido, whether it's Calderon.
Juan Guaido being the Venezuelan opposition figure who's declared himself president of Venezuela, recognized by the U.S.
Right. Guaido, he's kind of a nobody. He got 70,000. He was elected with 70,000 votes in the third or second least populous state of Venezuela. But behind him is basically a white-collar mafia. You've got Carlos Vecchio, who's the fake ambassador here in D.C., and Vecchio was the former lawyer for ExxonMobil, which was kicked out of Venezuela when Hugo Chavez nationalized the oil. You got Calderon Berti, who's the fake ambassador of Venezuela in Colombia, from Vestra Energy, which is a major energy firm that's seeking to get its tentacles back into Venezuela. Then you have Jose Ignacio Hernandez, who is the prosecutor of the fake Venezuelan government, who has been prosecuting this case to seek to basically punish Venezuela's actual government for expropriating a Canadian mining company called Cristalex. And Hernandez himself turns out to have been a longtime paid expert witness for Cristalex, which is just a complete conflict of interest. But the point is, each of them, or Ricardo Hausman, who helped craft the coup and is at the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, overseeing a lot of the economic policies attacking Venezuela. He's a former director of the IMF, or a former board member at the IMF. So everyone represents a different international financial institution that wants to get its tentacles back into Venezuela. And so, you have at the street level, this experience with right-wing terror through the Guarimbas, and then you have a fake government that essentially just represents the corporate world. And the way that the actual elected government of Venezuela sees this is as a war for its own sovereignty, a war for national survival against international financial institutions, and an exterminationist right that would actually kill them in the streets if they were left defenseless.
Okay, so that was independent journalist Max Blumenthal on the Gray Zone Project with his report, U.S. sanctions on Venezuela are sociopathic. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. We'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM. You see anybody
else? Do you have questions about sexual health strategies? Do you want to get tested to know your HIV status? Every Monday, HIV/AIDS Resources and Community Health offers free, rapid HIV testing that is anonymous and confidential. Results are known within 20 minutes and no appointments are necessary. We offer the service on a first-come, first-served basis from 1:30 to 3 p.m. and we have extended hours every first and third Monday of the month from 3:30 to 6 p.m. Our nurse can also book follow-up appointments for other STI tests depending on your risk factors or results. Come check us out at our accessible location on 77 Westmount Road, Unit 110. Or get more info at www.archguelph.ca/testing.
No bumps on this ride, let it glide. With Planet Groove and your funky blues doctor serving you up an audio buffet every Friday at 10 a.m. of blues, rock, funk, and more on CFRU 93.3 FM, baby.
The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, Chapter 4.
I cannot understand why you should wish to leave this beautiful country and go back to the dry, gray place you call Kansas. That's because you have no brains, answered Dorothy. No matter how dreary and gray our homes are, we people of flesh and blood would rather live there than in any other country. Be it ever so beautiful, there's no place like home. The Scarecrow sighed deeply. I guess you're right. And there's no place to insure your home like Kilgore Mutual. When it comes to comprehensive liability coverage, those guys are the real wizards. You said it, cried the Tin Man. Their helpful brokers make insurance seem simple. Kilgore Mutual, the Scarecrow smiled. A subsidiary of Globalcom LLC. Toward evening, they came to a great...
If we don't support public libraries, someone else will. Sign the petition to restore funding for Ontario libraries at saveourlibraries.ca.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR. So before the break, we of course heard Max Blumenthal of the Gray Zone Project. Now, fortunately, there has been solidarity shown towards Venezuela from various progressive forces in North America. For example, you might have heard about how activists occupied the Venezuelan consulate in Washington, D.C. earlier this year to prevent it from falling in. And they did this with the support of the Venezuelan government. They occupied the consulate to prevent it from falling into the hands of Trump's hand-picked Venezuelan representative Juan Guaido and his cronies. You know, Juan Guaido being the person that Trump basically thinks should be the president of Venezuela, even backed him when he unilaterally declared himself the president of Venezuela earlier this year, even though he never won an election, you know, never even ran a presidential election in his life. Not the legitimate president, but Trump's backing this guy and tried to hand over the consulate in Washington, D.C. to him and his representatives. Progressive activists occupied the consulate, tried to prevent that from happening, and held out for quite a long time before they eventually were forced to leave. But people have also been traveling to Venezuela itself to show their solidarity with the people there in their struggle against U.S. imperialism. I want to play this one interview that appeared recently on the Real News Network. It was with Netra Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace, who was also part of the group of activists defending the Venezuelan consulate in Washington, and who recently was in Venezuela as part of a solidarity delegation. And the spirit of internationalism expressed by this man is truly inspiring. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Thank you. This is Jacqueline Lukeman with the Real News Network. A delegation of U.S. members of the Embassy Protection Collective have returned from spending 10 days in Venezuela, meeting with community leaders, social organizations, and government officials, including a private meeting with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. If you recall, for 37 days, and with the permission of the democratically elected government of Venezuela, members of the Embassy Protection Collective held the space in the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., and refused to hand over control of the building to the U.S.-backed and selected president, Juan Guaido, and his ambassador, Carlos Vecchio. Here to talk to me today in the studio about this trip is Netfa Freeman. Netfa is a member of the Black Alliance for Peace Coordinating Committee and is also an organizer with Pan-African Community Action here in Washington, D.C. Netfa, thank you so much for joining me in the studio today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So talk about this trip. Give me just your general overall impressions of this trip, just as a member of the delegation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a pretty fantastic trip, in my opinion. One, we went there to not only meet with the others, and I think you might have mentioned, I'm not sure, we participated in the Sao Paulo Forum, which is a forum of grassroots movements and organizations of Latin America, the Latin American left. And it's been going on ever since the first one in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and it's adopted the name Sao Paulo Forum because of what the first one was. This year, it was in Venezuela, following, actually, the meeting of the non-aligned meeting. A non-aligned meeting, and it's an alignment of states, of governments in the South that are opposing U.S. hegemony and European and U.S. hegemony. So that was the governments, and then following that is the grassroots organizations all in Venezuela. We also met with a number, like you said, a number of grassroots movements or people's organizations or people's projects. We say people-centered projects that Venezuela has in supporting, where people are organizing communes, people's communes on the ground to deal with their regular everyday life and their human needs, basic human needs, childcare, healthcare, those kind of things. So we even visited places that constructed their own apartments and then created like bakeries and healthcare centers and childcares in there and are working together to maintain the facilities and everything or the commune for themselves. We met with the human rights envoy to the United Nations of Larry DeVoe of Venezuela, the Venezuelan human rights envoy, and he talked about the whole issue of human rights and how it's skewed and what really issues they're dealing with. And so it's a number of things that we did. And then, of course, like you said, we had the private meeting with President Nicolas Maduro. Also, one of the things we did was we participated in the Sao Paulo Forum, we participated in a session of Afro-descendants. Mm-hmm. In the Sao Paulo Forum, which came up with a number of declarations or resolutions that were their contribution to the Sao Paulo Forum.
I want to start, I think, with your meeting with the human rights representative, mm-hmm. and his perspective on the U.S. narrative on quote-unquote human rights abuses that officials in this country are frequently accusing the Maduro government and the government before him of committing against the people of Venezuela. What were his comments about that, and what are your perspectives on that?
It was very refreshing to get that take, and I think largely his comments and also our criticisms of the U.S. Imperialist media as a lot of stuff that's left out. Some of the things, well, they leave out the opposition's atrocities against people, like particularly people of African descent, burning a young man alive in the streets, or anybody who's suspected of being a Chavista, they would commit all kinds of murders. Now, some of the things that the U.S. is accuses countries of is the police, you know, coming down, the agents of the state coming down on the opposition and beating them,
right,
and doing certain
right.
things. Now,
he was careful to make sure we didn't say that that didn't happen. But what is also missing from the imperialist narrative is that they've prosecuted police for these things. And people have been up against trials, and one person was even jailed, a police officer. So it's not like they're not aware of it. These things are not things that are sanctioned by the government. These are people, you know, things get out of hand, or maybe somebody else is just taking it upon themselves to do things, and they're not denying those things, but it's not what you hear in the media. And then how the sanctions are a violation of the human rights, how they've affected food and medicines and those kind of things, and how the media pretends that those aren't the things that are affected by it.
So I'm glad you raised the issue of sanctions, because recently there was another round of sanctions imposed on Venezuela by this administration. And apparently, a report was released that a Venezuelan official had personal sanctions issued against him after meeting with someone in this administration. And of course, we just heard about the shipment of food that was intercepted and denied to be delivered to Venezuela. Because of the sanctions from this administration. Why is it that people in this country do not equate those kinds of sanctions and food blockades and medicine blockades, which is this administration claims it does not stop medicine from entering into these countries, but we have seen that that's not true. Why do people in this country not equate those actions with violations of the human rights of the people of Venezuela?
I would say, and one is largely because of the low level of political understanding and the culpability of the media in that understanding. And so they don't talk about the effects of sanctions. They often spin sanctions, the media often spin sanctions as targeted sanctions or, you know, targeting individuals, those kind of things. And they don't deal with the impact that it has on countries. I mean, we saw it in Iraq when Madeleine Albright was even smug about how many sanctions, how many people in Iraq the U.S. killed, how many children. And so, but normally, you know, the people just don't pay attention to the details of politics, and the media doesn't help people understand things like that. And so they spend a lot of time demonizing an individual, and it's also about individuals. And they also make it all about individuals, and they're not showing the mass demonstrations that are against the imperialism and against the U.S. aggression. We don't hear from people on the ground, you know, unless they can plot, pick some person, and just even sometimes taking their comments out of context. So things like sanctions and reports, like the Center for Economic Policy Research came out with a report. Since 2017, over 40,000 people died as a result of the sanctions in Venezuela, as a result of the sanctions the United States has imposed. And this happens all the time. So also the sanctions always accompany, and this is another part that shows that a lot of times the corporate media operates, as I say, as the fourth branch of the government, is that they're always accompanied by propaganda and by also the using of the white, olive, you know, rich, privileged class as proxies on the ground. They'll either interview them or, like in the case of Juan Guaido and his cohort, be positioning them to be able to take over when these are not people that really represent the interests of the masses of people in a country, but they're presented as doing so. So people never see, you know, the regular black and brown Venezuelans on the ground and the protests that they have and hear what they explain about their country and their process of democracy that we never hear about. How is voting taking place? What kind of mass assemblies? Do they have mass assemblies where people talk? Because this is really what happens in Venezuela and a lot of places. But we don't even, one, they don't have it here. There's no mass assemblies talking about things that are binding and the government officials and whatnot have to implement. So that's not even something people can understand or wrap their minds around normally. And then also how the voting process happens is often very convoluted and complex in this country. And then in other countries, they just don't even cover it. It's just they will always throw, as a result of, following the results of an election, oh, those are in question. You know, people question those elections and the results aren't. And then Maduro is not legitimate because there was something. And they don't even explain what. They don't go into details, and, you know, and that's all people got to hear.
So you
just raised the issue of people in this country not seeing the black and brown, mostly black and brown working class citizens in Venezuela who are basically living out a democracy that we don't even have here in this country in regard to elections. Going back to why you were there as a member of the Embassy Protection Collective. There was a specific dynamic that we saw outside of the embassy during that 37 days that was raised pretty immediately, I think after 2 or 3 days when the counter-protesters finally began to show up. And we noticed that the makeup of the counter-protesters was pretty specific. And then it was raised, the point that you just made, that the counter-protesters outside of the embassy in Venezuela don't actually represent the body of the population in Venezuela, and certainly doesn't represent the political backbone of the people of Venezuela who are Chavistas and who are defending their electoral process and their right to determination. Let me ask, did President Maduro speak to those issues about representation, how his country's people, how the people of Venezuela are represented in this country, and what that means for how Venezuela is seen and how he's seen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did speak to that. We did have a meeting with President Nicolas Maduro. There was just the Embassy Protection Collective. Myself and Vanessa Beck were there, also part of the collective representing the Black Alliance for Peace. And so our particular mission was to advance our principle of building a people-centered human rights project against imperialism, war, and repression. And so that's why we were there. So it was a little bit slightly different in the sense of that it overlaps with the other people that were there, but we're representing black people, and we're not, you know, so doing so thinking what that we're trying to hold our government accountable. We see the repression that Venezuela and the people of Venezuela face as the same thing we're facing here domestically inside the United States and around the world. And so we're identifying with the people who are the targets of that oppression because we are of them versus people who, you know, have some relationship to the oppressor but don't agree with the policies. So that's a little different. And one of to answer to your question is that, and so just also to conclude that is that we, our reason for supporting Venezuela is the same reason we have for supporting Haiti and our people in Honduras and Africa or anything. And so we have to, you know, see it that way, is that, that we're building our people's movement, and that we have to also, you know, hold people to try to make people see the connections. Nicolas Maduro, President Nicolas Maduro, raised something very interesting. He's a very astute person, I think. A lot of times you hear all this, you know, stuff about people. They focus so much on individuals, and he was very humanist and talked about the, you know, he's a murderer and all these kind of things, things that don't really pan out. But one of the things he raised was the reviving of, I think it's very instructive for us to understand and know about this, the reviving of the Monroe Doctrine and anti-communism. And so when he's looking at it mostly from the lens, and which is what government officials from another country do, their responsibility is to deal with their own country. But what I saw is like, oh, this is also the foreign policy that mirrors the domestic policies we're facing. Monroe Doctrine, white supremacy, anti-communism, our struggle as black and brown people, working class black and brown people in the United States, facing austerity, gentrification, increased police repression, mass incarceration, all that kind of stuff, is what we're facing here that mirrors the foreign policy that the United States and the Western governments are leveling against Venezuela and other countries, particularly countries that are trying to chart their own path and exercise their right to self-determination. It's like, we live in a world that's trying to take us down a neoliberal path that offers nothing to anyone except disregard for people's human rights and self-determination, diminishing resources that they want to keep and hold to themselves for upper class oligarchy of the world that is largely white and Western and European. For us, we have to build something that's more conservationist in terms of resources. resources and the environment, and also cooperation as opposed to competition. There's this competition and you know, appropriation. Ours has to be cooperation and conservation. And so we got to see that foreign policy and the domestic policy mirror each other, and they're bipartisan in their approach. Because right now we ain't seeing any of the candidates talking about, you know, they say they're claiming they're against Trump, but nobody's really talking about the racism reflected in these foreign policies against Venezuela. The blatant gangsterism of seizing, I think you mentioned this ship, a food shipment going through Panama. They seized that shipment, claiming that they're not for, you know, they're for the people of Venezuela, but you're going to take the food. You know, this is blatant stuff. I mean, we have progressive policymakers that everyone wants to lift up, and that's fine, but they got to take a position. It's their responsibility to, because you have a lot of media attention. We don't get a media attention, the real mainstream media. They got to use that platform. I mean, this is what we're up against. And, you know, and I think this shows that when we end up, when some people end up either pledging allegiance or putting themselves in a position to have to demonstrate allegiance mm-hmm. to the United States, it comes with strings attached that means you have to in some way embrace or be quiet about the policies, some of the most blatant policies of repression, war, and imperialism that the country characterized by the country.
But Netfa, what about people whose criticism of your participation and the Embassy Protection Collectives and Black Alliance for Peace's participation in these kinds of events where you are taking a meeting with someone that they will say is a dictator and who is a criminal. So they use that to say, you met with a dictator and a criminal, so that invalidates anything else you have to say about criticism of the United States. How does people's response that you know is that way, how does that factor into this whole argument of anti-imperialism?
Mm-hmm. One, we have to understand that capitalism and imperialism comes with propaganda. They're trying to tell us what to think without any critical analysis, no information. And we also are not supposed to consider that they lie. Kwame Ture used to say, it doesn't lie some of the time, they lie all of the time. And so they will always bandy around. They bandy around terms like dictator, terrorist, communist, and we're supposed to accept those things without any critical analysis, without any information that we're able to research and follow up on, refute or confirm, you know, these things. And so I'm not going to, but there are things that we do know that should inform our understanding so that we're not fooled or duped by or hoodwinked by what they say. So you're not going to come and tell me I'm supposed to believe that Nicolas Maduro is a dictator, but yet domestically you know and don't do anything about the propaganda that says our movements are influenced by the Russians. And that's what's out there in the media right now. They're saying we're influenced by Russian propaganda. We don't have a sense enough to understand. So that's what's motivating our fight for self-determination and liberation against police and those kind of things. Or that we're black identity extremists, we're, you know, fostering. These are things that are meant to undermine our movement, not bring truth. It used to be a time when we would know, and people like Malcolm X warned us that we have to think for ourselves. They will tell us that we should be going west. If we listen to them, we'll be going west when we should be going east. We'll be going right when we should be going left, those kind of things. And so we have to be able to see through that. And there's another question at stake there that you mentioned. Yes, we sat and we met with Nicolas Maduro. One, the people of Venezuela, when we should be able to go and find out things for ourselves. That was part of the mission. The people of Venezuela were so grateful, not just Nicolas Maduro, people were so grateful for us standing in the embassy and protecting the embassy everywhere we went. And so sitting with Nicolas Maduro and anyone else in Venezuela is to hear for ourselves what they have to say, to be able to sit side, you know, and scrutinize for ourselves, not to be told what it is about them. So that also goes along, is related to the principle of the right of self-determination. You know, the right of self-determination, of national self-determination, means Venezuela has that right, and we got to respect that right. We can't be, you know, aiding and abetting the imperialist narrative that says this is a dictator and that's why they're going on. They don't care about human rights.
I mean, there's nothing about what they do that cares about human rights when you support, like, Saudi Arabia that doesn't even have elections and is a monarchy, or you bomb innocent children in Yemen and in Syria and those kind of things, and you prop up dictators and depose democratically elected people in Honduras, in Haiti.
Explain why the Sao Paulo conference is so important, not just to the representation and the voices of Afro-Venezuelan, Afro-Latino people, Afro-Caribbean people, but also to Black people in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So this was and I thought it was really important that they both came on the heels of one. The Sao Paulo came on the heels of the non-aligned movement too. But the Sao Paulo Forum is a chance for us to connect with people, grassroots movements in Latin America of the left, and find out what common interests do we have? How can we cooperate with each other, you know, across international lines? And it wasn't just the Sao Paulo Forum. And, you know, I don't know if you were saying this, but just to be clear, that it wasn't just about Afro-Latino. That was a component of the broader forum.
I see.
And so there was the Afro-Latino, you know, forum. Mm-hmm. There were different sessions, women, one for women, youth, all kind of things, and everyone contributed to the larger forums, declarations against imperialism. And this is the kind of thing also, it's very seldomly that people from the United States, and we have to really be organized here, that we actually connect with movements and formations and congregations like that, gatherings like that. We have to be part of that. Often it's a little bit unique here because we're actually in the belly of the beast. We are living in a country that is the citadel of the capitalism and imperialism in the world. And sometimes people come when you come there and they look at you like why are they here? You know, that kind of thing. Hmm. So we have to be able to show up and show we are in it, but we're not of it. We look at Black people in particular, and we're not just talking about Black people, but us in particular. We're a domestic colony in this United States. So if we would look at things from a political science point of view, everything that characterizes colonization, we face. It's not about the geographic, you know, the distance between the colonized and the metropole. It's about the conditions of power and exploitation. And we face that here. Sometimes people don't understand that. They get all kind of other propaganda. They don't, you know, we don't have a voice and we don't have media that allows us to articulate what we're up against. So we have to go to places sometimes and spread whatever means of media we do have, but also to explain that we're also facing repression. You know, as one of the things with the Afro descendants, in one of the things I brought up, and they know. I mean, some people they know stuff, but I brought up that the declarations might need to say something explicit about African people in the United States. And they embraced it, but it just didn't occur to them right away, and they also rightly so criticized me because I was out of the room when it was time to raise that issue.
So I'm glad you brought that point up, the connection between this a forum on Afro-descended people in Venezuela at the Sao Paulo conference and the colonized condition of African Americans, and making this connection there and bringing that connection here, because I want to end on this. Why is this development important that happened at the Sao Paulo conference, at the Forum on Afro-Descendants, in this conversation that we are having in this moment with the ADOS movement and their view, a very dim and dismissive view of Pan-Africanism in particular?
Mm-hmm. Well, one, that what happened in the Sao Paulo Forum, they, and part of their resolution, was explicitly talking about Pan-Africanism, and they termed revolutionary Pan-Africanism. So we got a, you know, it's a digression for us to get away from that. We have a movement that goes back quite some time and has been attacked in so many ways. So what happens is, so now they're trying to revive and re-embrace the Pan-African movement, particularly on making connections with our brothers and sisters on the continent of Africa. So it's explicitly mentioned in their resolutions. We have to do the same thing and realize that anything else, when we call ourselves, you know, American descendants of slaves, that means everything started at the Middle Pass, after the Middle Passage, and that our allegiance is to this capitalist imperialist system that represses us right here in the United States and
doesn't want us to have connections and make the links between the repression that they level against our people in other places. So it's very important. They operate on a global level and are very sophisticated and very clear about their interests of full spectrum dominance is what they actually term it. And so we have to be just as clear and just as sophisticated and struggle to win.
Thank you so much, Netfa, for joining me in the studio today and bringing this incredible knowledge with us.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching, for joining us. Continue to watch our coverage of not only the unfolding events in Venezuela, but around the world, where people are continuing to fight for self-determination in the face of capitalism and imperialism. This is Jacqueline Lukman with the Real News Network. Thank you for watching.
You're listening.